two, one, two.
Good. Good morning and welcome to WMFO in Medford. That's Tufts Free Forum, commercial-free, community-based radio. And we are... Let's see. Sorry about that. Little something going on with the mic. We are Tufts Free Forum, commercial-free, community-based radio. Tufts Free Forum, etc. And we're a little slice of that community-based socialist alternative radio. And we are here every other Sunday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And there's a little bit of static. Do you guys hear that in your mics?
Not really.
You guys aren't up yet. Hold on. Two and four. Are you on? What number are you? You're four? Are you two?
Two.
Okay. Can you hear now?
Nope.
Try that. Try that. Or is that mine? Yeah, there you go. Now I know what happened. There's a loose connection. So I'm okay. You guys... I don't know, Tom, where your knob is, maybe over here.
Yeah.
All right, we're all set. Sorry for the technical difficulties. Again, socialist alternative radio, talk and music from a working class, democratic socialist perspective. And we're here for the next 2 hours, and we're here every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Check out our Facebook page, Socialist Alternative Radio. And also for more general political things we're talking about, check out socialistalternative.org. And we'll get back into ways to get involved and talk to us and so on. In a few, today we're going to talk about a lot about May 1st, International Workers' Day. That is, believe it or not, an American holiday. And some of our listeners, I think our regular listeners have probably heard of it, but some of our listeners tuning in for the first time might not have heard of it. By the way, we go out live over the air here on WMFO, which is brilliant, but we also go out over the internet. So we do have national, international listeners, and you will hear us talking to them sometimes. We're not just going to talk about things happening here in Somerville, Medford, Greater Boston, however important they are. We're going to also talk about things happening in other places around the world. So, once again, fiddling with the things here. Okay. So, Mike, we have a lot of people in the studio today. My name's Jeff.
Diego.
Tom.
And we're with three co-hosts for the show today, usually only one or two. So welcome, everybody.
Three socialists.
You can't? Okay. How about now?
There you go.
Let's reintroduce ourselves. Jeff.
Tom.
Diego.
All right. And we are, like I said, going to talk about May 1st. If we have time, we'll talk about the environment and socialism, riffing off of the science marches from yesterday. We're going to talk about some of the most egregious Trumpisms in the last week or so. And there are so many, of course. And we'll be talking about a socialist alternative member running for city council out in Minneapolis, Ginger Jensen. If we have time, I think we have to make sure we have time for that. And every once in a while, we might throw some music on. So again, if you've never heard the show before, it is as we described, talk and music from a working class, democratic socialist perspective. And we are, we've been on the air here for, I don't know, a decade, I guess. If you haven't heard of us, it's because of the monopolization of the airwaves by the corporate media and big business. They just give that stuff away to the rich and the powerful, but in some stations, usually to the left of the dial, ironically, around the college stations.
Well, last night I was watching Citizen Kane.
You'll find some other stuff.
Citizen Kane.
That says a lot.
Yeah.
About corporate media. He didn't really have an alternative there, even when he was...
Hertz?
Even when he was up and coming and critical, he didn't have much of an alternative.
But it was sad.
Like Orson
Rosebud.
Welles. Yeah, it was sad. Well, you know, Orson Welles, he was involved in left-wing theater in the 30s. But his everything I've read about that is his loyalties were divided. Like, he didn't like the fact that theater workers were unionizing in the 30s. He's like, union, this is art. What do you need a union for? Well, because Orson, we need to eat. You know, yeah. That's why. Yeah. You might have the money, but we don't.
The rest of them.
Yeah, we don't have the money. No, he was never a serious political activist, but there was such a, imagine, you know, the 30s, right, with the Depression. It was such a everything was shifted to the left for the most part. There was, of course, a vicious right wing, even fascist right wing in America, but the vast majority of people were shifting to the left, disgusted with their living standards and the drop in living standards, etc. And so even someone that wanted to stay out of that and just be an artiste like Monsieur,
yeah, well, his solution to the problems was to scare the hell out of people with War of the Worlds on the radio.
That was pretty cool, I gotta say. But the fake news, that was talking about fake news.
Did he do that intentionally, do you think? Or that it was just, well, I people were tuning in at the wrong, like, not in the beginning, where he did say, this is just a, you know, a play.
Yeah, that's how he, that's so how he avoided a lot of lawsuits, I think.
I don't think they knew that he was, I don't think he knew what the reaction would be. I don't know if he thought that that qualifier at the beginning would be enough or not. I don't know about that. I haven't read much about it, but I think I've read that he was shocked at the reaction. I think anyone would be, you know. People are like running for wherever they were running for.
Well, he was more shocked in a sense of the word, like, really, Americans really went for it? Like,
that true.
Are we that, that uneducated too, yeah, to go, yeah, what?
We are. We have still, latest figures I've seen are, and it was dropping actually, only 28% of Americans had a passport. Therefore, you know, unless a lot of people are finding a way to travel without one, which I don't know of.
I got
to
carry mine everywhere.
that I don't know. It's like so many people just haven't even gone to Canada. Do you need a passport even for Canada? That, you know, it's just really bad for a country to have so many people that haven't traveled anywhere else. I think that's why jingoism is so. I mean, I was just staring on the way in at yet another pickup truck with an American flag on it. I'm like, is that really necessary, you have to have the house with a flag, the truck with a flag? I mean, do you realize you're more brainwashed than the Nazis? I don't think they had Nazi flags everywhere, you know what I mean?
Well, I've seen this Jeep with the biggest flag in the back. I'm like,
yeah. And you know, again, nationalism is a double-edged sword. I mean, for some people, it means things that you can understand that are good. You know, like, well, I care about the people I live with. I have pride in my community, that kind of thing. But there must be other ways to show that than doubling down with everything that the elites do in America.
Well, and on the other hand, they geography is not taught the way it was once.
No,
was
no.
People well, point to the, are asked to point to outlines of countries on global maps and can't tell.
Well, I remember post 9/11, before 9/11 happened, it wasn't that. You didn't see a lot of American flags. It was right after 9/11. Everybody, get your flags out. Just in case. Even the people that then were nationalistic, yo, just in case, because we don't want, you know, people think we're anti-American.
You don't want the mob to show up and burn you out of your home. Yeah. No, I think it's like I don't agree 100% with that. I agree like 90% that it definitely intensified. But I still remember before that, like, traveling.
The first Iraq War, there were those yellow ribbons everywhere.
Yeah, but I just remember traveling to other countries for the first time, which I've been lucky to do, and actually live in another country for a short time. And there is not the level of nationalism and jingoism that there is here. They're just not. You don't see the flag everywhere.
So
of
in
that
France,
country.
You don't see all these French flags everywhere.
You don't see it in people's, like, you know, hanging off their balconies or in the front of their house or something like that. You know. You just don't. They're there in the official government buildings, of course, but they're just not everywhere.
Yeah.
And
Le Pen is trying to heat that up, though. She's trying to build that nationalism up.
Yeah, he's going to be a chauvinist.
Yeah. Well, you know, let's talk about that in a minute, but first let's talk about our Trumpisms for the week or beyond. Now, and I use that term loosely because it's not just Trump, obviously. It's the capitalist elite. Trump is just a puppet for them. And he's one of them, too, actually. He's making money off all this. But Paul Ryan, I would include under the Trump, in the Trump universe. He's the current Speaker of the House. He's a Republican. And he's sort of, in some ways, in my mind, replaced Trump as the biggest moron on the planet you know, whatever. And I'm not saying this from your typical, by the way, if you're tuning in for the first time, we're not liberals here. We're socialists. We're revolutionary socialists. We don't like the Democrats either. Hillary Clinton is an evil, evil person who wanted to bomb more of Syria than Trump did recently. That's right before, I don't know if everyone hear about that, right before Trump announced, like about a few hours before that, Hillary was every airfield in Syria should be bombed. Bada boom. So, you know, all you liberals out there think Hillary would have been different. What Hillary would have done is...
She wanted a no-fly zone. So you shut down a Russian MiG, we're at war with Russia.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Well, I was thinking about today on the way in with Hillary is that if the election had gone the way people thought, a lot of people thought, that we didn't think this in Social Alternative, but we didn't think Trump would win, but we thought it would be close. But in a lot of people out there were like, Trump's going to get killed. He's just such an idiot. He's showing himself to be an idiot. He's a misogynist and all that. All that's true, by the way. What they didn't understand is right-wing populism. They didn't understand how liberalism has no solutions and no popularity among huge sections of Americans. I mean, we understood that, but we still thought Trump would lose, but it would be close. But again, Trump squeaks in, right? But what if it had gone the way a lot of people thought in the upper middle class liberal intelligentsia and all that? What if it had gone that way and Hillary had won with a big mandate? I think we would already be in war. We'd already be in war.
Worse than deeper war,
yeah. Because they would have run with that. You know, she would have gone nuts. It wasn't a big factor in the elections, by the way. Remember that? The Democrats, Sanders is not... Sanders, in my opinion, is very weak on fighting imperialism. He doesn't fight it, basically. He agrees with a lot of it. Hillary, of course, is straight up, pro-imperialist and wants to do the dirty work of imperialism. And would have. With that mandate, she would have rushed us into war, you know? And there wouldn't have been, like... what people think, you know, everything would have been softer and nicer and all that. There would have been less of what I'm about to read in the beginning, but just because you put a nice face on capitalism doesn't mean the attacks on, you know, civil liberties, the attacks on social welfare, and the attacks on other countries disappear in any way. But anyway, let's get back to Paul Ryan
You know how you were talking about last couple of shows? Most of these cuts going on to the working class or, you know, social mobility or, has been Democrats.
Exactly, especially at the local level in big cities. Like, Democrats did lose a lot of seats in the last election, the most recent election in November. But before that, and even now, they control huge, important states, New York, California, Massachusetts isn't that important, but it's kind of important. They control so many inner city city councils, you know, city, I'm sorry, I don't mean to say inner city, city councils. And the policies coming out of there are straight up neoliberal policies, really horrible. Like we gave the example, I think last time, but in case we didn't, we'll go over it again. Recently in Baltimore, Maryland, the Democratic mayor who campaigned on supporting a $15 minimum wage vetoed a $15 minimum wage. In Montgomery County in Maryland also, I forget what the title of the person was, but he apparently had veto power. I don't know if he was mayor or some other title. Also a Democrat vetoed a $15 minimum wage. And Montgomery County was considered a rich county. And both of those $15 minimum wage laws in Baltimore and Montgomery County in Maryland were weak. They were very, very pro, you know, business had gotten a lot of concessions from those laws, and they didn't pass anyway. Now we have the situation in Minneapolis, which we'll get into, where Socialist Alternative is running a candidate named Ginger Jensen, who's already well known in the city for fighting for 15, and Socialist Alternative started a 15 Now campaign based in the airport workers and based in the city as a whole. And we mentioned this on the show before, that last November, it was supposed to be on the ballot, a referendum for $15 minimum wage. It was polling at 65% or more around there. And at the last minute, but here's the thing, all but two Democrats were against it. Okay, so they got together with the ones that were against it, got together with the Republican, and they were all Democrats on the city council, and that was about 12 or something like that. They got together with the some Republican judges and got some legal maneuver in to yank the referendum off the ballot at the last minute. Now, to continue to poll high, and what I just read literally like yesterday, I think it was, most of the Democrats are now in favor, quote unquote, of 15. And there's a good chance it's going to get onto a referendum or go through as legislation, although there's been no legislation put forward yet. So it might still have to be a referendum, but it might probably be legislation. But what we're fighting now out there through Ginger Jensen's campaign and through the 15 Now campaign is no tip exceptions. You know, like they want to, like in some 15 $1 minimum wage things. Restaurant workers don't get it because the theory from big business, they get tips. But anyone that's ever worked for tips knows that you can't survive on that. It's just like a lower wage, basically.
They didn't realize that also people that are waitresses get less money than the cooks. They make $5 because of the tips.
Yeah, the tips, tips, tips.
People don't say that.
Yeah,
I know because I've seen that happen.
Well, the minimum wage for restaurant workers is ridiculously low federally. There's a federal minimum wage is really low, but it's like, what, $2.50 an hour? You know, in some places, you don't have to pay what? Is it like literally $2.50 an hour, I think. I could be wrong, but I think that's what it is. Then you're supposed to live off your tips after that. Or the restaurant can decide to give you more than that. And in many cities, they're forced to. But a lot of places, they don't. And even in the cities where they're paying a higher wage, they're still scamming the workers on tips and saying you'll make whatever. And the whole tip thing is just wrong from start to finish. I mean, it hurts. It hurts the workers. They don't get enough money. It hurts the restaurant workers that have to rely on it. And it's also degrading. They have to like be get good tips. And they've studied in places where the tips don't exist. Because some restaurants don't do it. Very few, but some don't do it. And there's no like, it's not, that doesn't mean your waiter comes up and slaps you or something. You know, it just means that they're not pretending to be your false friend, you know. And then
they're not reading a script that they got me doing at this pizza place. Hi, your first time here? Well, welcome. You know, like... I got people walking in going, I just walk in happy days, you know?
Well, I went to, someone took me for an anniversary thing or something. I forget what it was. It wasn't my wife, but this is years ago. Someone took me to a very fancy restaurant. That, like one of the big ones you hear about in Boston. At the time, it was like a hot item, like Lydia Shire's place.
Newberry Street kind of restaurant.
Near there, yeah. So I've never been to one this fancy. And I couldn't believe the waiters and waitresses. They didn't just fawn all over you. They pretended to really like know your life and like you and really, you know, I was just shocked by it. I didn't know how to react, you know. And my friend is sort of talking with them because she's used to that sort of thing, yeah. I guess. And I was like, I was just flummoxed. I was like, I was grossed out by it. And then another time, I went to like, not a fancy place, but like an upscale place in Brookline. I had a girlfriend who liked to go to this place, so we would go there every once in a while. This is illustrative of what I'm talking about. So, and I don't blame the workers for this, I'm just saying. So my girlfriend at the time, she was she had like a rapport with one of the waitresses. And whenever we came in, this was about once every couple months, she would get that waitress, right? And the waitress would pretend to be really friendly. And I thought it was genuine. This is, I don't know, I guess I had forgotten my previous experience. It was a different atmosphere or something. And we would talk about like good places to go swimming and stuff like that. And like, I thought that they really liked each other, you know. And I just sort of jumped in, you know, from time to time with a comment. So one day we go in, and this had been like over the course of a year, and the place something was off, something was a little wrong, and all the waiters and waitresses were just sort of lazing about, hanging out, not really doing anything. And when she came up to our table, she was like very frosty. And my friend couldn't understand what was going on. And
was it
going
to be a strike?
Worse, unfortunately. It would have been great if it was a strike. If it was a strike, they probably would have been friendly because they want our support. But what happened was instead, this person, we found out when we left that the place was going to close. That was like their last week, like one of their last days of work. So she didn't
start knocking down tables.
She didn't have to pretend to be a friend of ours anymore, a friend of my friend.
Get away from me.
And yeah, and they didn't have to work that hard. Which I don't mind that part. But anyway, the point is that like the whole tip thing is just rife with like sexual harassment and all sorts of other problems. You don't need tips. And then you just can't survive on them usually. You do good on a Saturday night. It's like construction work. Yeah, construction work, sometimes you get high pay, especially if you're a union, but you don't know if you're going to work that long, you know, when the job's going to end, if you're going to get another job right away, you know? So it's like these waitresses, you do good on a Saturday night, what happens to the rest of the week? You used to be in catering, right? So are you agreeing with this or disagreeing?
No,
or?
I'm agreeing with
it. Okay, all right, yeah. Tom used to do that, yeah. It's hard work, too.
Yes,
it's like
it
very
is.
Under, it's like childcare. Childcare workers should get so much money. They should get what CEOs get, and restaurant workers that work their butts off.
Catering is worse.
A lot more money.
Is worse in some ways because you have to be fawn. Talk about fawning. You have to fawn on the customer.
The one hiring you. Yeah.
The one who's hiring you becomes sort of like Louis the 14th. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then they also feel entitled to criticize every single aspect of what you've worked hard to do. But on the other side, a lot of caterers pay under the table, and they withhold pay. It's
nasty business.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Well, speaking of food, back to Paul Ryan and
all business
the Trump
is nasty.
It is, yeah. Well, I had that discussion. I literally had that discussion. One more anecdote with a small business owner that's interested in socialist alternative, and he has a very small like business, but he was giving me the small business patter, even though he's left wing supposedly in his head.
And he's the owner?
He's the owner of a very small business, but he's involved in progressive politics. And he said, like, and I said, well, you know, he started off like with stuff about propaganda about small business. I said, well, you know, we in Social Alternative, believe it or not, we don't have anything against small businesses per se. We want, you know, there are times when socialist parties and so on organize small business people in with workers through, better terms of credit, better conditions, you know, in general. You know, a small business owner that doesn't have to pay for health insurance is going to save money. You know, there's all these ways to entice, even with 15 now in Seattle, where we led the $15 minimum wage battle that won a few years ago. We did make an appeal to small businesses to try to stop them from opposing it. Didn't work with most of them, but some of them actually came on board and said, yeah, I want to pay my workers, quote unquote, 15, because it's a decent wage and blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, we will try to organize small business people, but with no illusions that the majority of them are really going to go for it, you know, because every small business wants to be a big business, you know, blah, blah. So he, in fact, did start giving me the small business propaganda.
Well, the way you tell them, more buying power, more money, more business.
Right. I use that argument. Exactly.
Right.
But I also
said, it's just mathematically correct.
Right.
Less buying power.
Right.
You suffer because people are not buying. They're not going out to eat at your restaurant or whatever it is.
There is a counter argument to that under capitalism, unfortunately. And that is that the more they pay out in wages, the less they get in surplus value. Or the less they get, to put it simply, the less they get in profit.
Take less surplus value.
Exactly. Right. That's the counter argument to that. So there's counter arguments to everything. But and some are true and some aren't. But anyway, so yeah, the bosses can say, look, if I pay this worker 15, this will cut into my profits. And there's actually your first argument can argue against that. You can say, well, if your business increases X amount, you will not only see not a drop in profits, you'll see an increase in profits. Despite the fact that if you each sort of, from your point of view, worker unit is costing you more.
You were saying Seattle, right? After that 15, through, it's booming.
Yeah, it's booming.
Because now people have better buying power. Yeah.
But
they're not making 11 or 10, they're making 15.
But the other argument is the one you said, that they can take less profit if push comes to shove. Like, say their market share doesn't grow, too bad. You take less profit, you know? The life of the worker is more important than the existence of your business. And then their counter-argument is, well, if my business exists, they wouldn't have a job. That's where this whole small business thing falls apart. And this is how I went after this guy a little bit, too. I said, look, man, all that propaganda about small businesses are the majority employers, That's true from a point of view that doesn't take into account like density, doesn't take into account certain areas, you know. Most small businesses fail, only 9 out of 10 small businesses fail within the first year.
Or first 5 months, like what happened to me.
And then you have basically like in certain areas, the majority employers are these big companies. You have other areas where they include small businesses in franchisees of bigger businesses, which doesn't really fit, in my opinion. And then, et cetera, et cetera. You have all these things that, well, that is a cooked statistic. You know, that means that you're counting every last person in the country, ignoring the fact that most people live in cities and most people work for these big corporations, you know. Unless you dump everybody into the pool. I'm not even sure that's true anymore, actually. That's just kind of small business propaganda. I'd really like to see the stats on that. But if the vast majority are not employed by big businesses, a significant chunk are, in fact, the most important chunk are in the larger businesses and the big corporations. So anyway, why do we get talking about that guy anyway, about small businesses? Is it the catering stuff?
Food.
Yeah. Well, again, bringing it back to the real food item here is, quote, Paul Ryan, Republican Speaker of the House of Representatives here in the United States, told a gathering of leaders and activists of the Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC, And Paul Ryan, according to this article, is a, quote, outspoken critic of the war on poverty. Now, wouldn't you like to be known as a critic of the war on poverty? Yes, I like
poverty. That just slapped me twice and backhanded.
Right. Oh, it gets worse.
He's a lifelong acolyte of Ayn Rand.
Yeah. And who ended up on Social Security? So without those social programs that she inveigled against, whatever the word is, invade against, she would have died. That's all you got to say about Ayn Rand right there. Yeah. And I know all about Ayn Rand. When I was in junior high, I was an Ayn Rand. In junior high, I was an Ayn Rand follower, reading all of her books except one. And then I don't know, barfing it all up and being cured when I did about ninth or 10th grade. So in my junior high, and I've compared notes with people. This is true of them too. Required reading in one of my English classes was a short story or novella called Anthem. And Anthem was about a rebellious adolescent in a totalitarian society. And very appealing to my anti-authoritarian mindset at the time. I hated my teachers. I hated school, basically. I was a very rebellious kid, like a lot of kids are. And so that led me to read all her other stuff, unlike most kids, thank God. I went out and read everything she wrote, except that one book, one of her last books. And it was this whole world of right-wing libertarianism, basically. You know, they had a name for it, objectivism, but basically it's right-wing libertarianism. Not that there's any left-wing libertarianism. It's just libertarianism, basically, with a whole set of codes and so on. And she was a white Russian. She was one of the rich Russians that got screwed over by the Russian Revolution. Yay. And had to leave Russia and come here. And so she writes all this stuff, Greed is Good, you know. You probably heard of Atlas Shrugged or The Fountainhead. These are her most famous novels. They were made into films. Libertarians swear by this stuff. This stuff is still in print, I believe. At least those two novels, I believe, they're still in print. Very popular among backward Americans who buy into libertarianism and so on.
Well, there was that Fountainhead also extolled terrorism because the main character destroys this building that he's created rather than have it be influenced or something.
One of her books basically extols rape. One of her books, terrorism. But basically the whole thing extols greed. Vicious, vicious greed. The greediest in society are, of course, the most talented. And blah, blah. I even heard that on the way
those
in today.
Those books should be banned.
Well, I heard this thing on the way in today where this is a study I like in a way, but in a way, the way they were reporting on it was disgusting. They were like, it was another lead level story. Like Tom has one if we have time for it. They did a study of lead levels in a certain area. They took 11-year-olds, interviewed them, gave them IQ tests that had been exposed to high lead. Then went back to them when they were 38. And what I didn't hear, maybe just because I didn't listen close enough, is were they still in the area or not? I don't know. And they found drops in IQ that they attributed to that early lead exposure. And here's the part that got me a little uncomfortable. Then they said, well, this will have impacts in society where people are exposed to lead because they'll lose IQ points. And I don't forget how they phrased it, but they won't be that smart. Of course, they didn't say that. And then they won't be able to get those well-paying jobs and work their way up the economic ladder. You like that? The economic ladder? It's a freaking pyramid, jerks, with a little tiny people that belong in prison on top and then most people at the bottom. It's a very thin pyramid, actually. It's not even a pyramid. I don't even know what to call it. And so that kind of pissed me off. I'm like, this guy's assuming that the only reason people don't get good jobs, that was the implication, was because they got exposed to lead when they were kids. Well, wait a minute. I bet you if you did that study further, you'd find out that most people are exposed to lead. So you could get rid of the factor of social mobility, which is still an illusion, I think, in their heads, the way they're doing that, completely. You know, you could say everyone exposed to lead, people with high IQs, they don't correlate with good jobs. I don't think any correlation, not to mention the problems with IQ tests, but I don't think there's any correlation between, you know, so-called intelligent people. I think intelligence is situational, personally, but say you have some sort of measure better than IQ tests and you discover that. I don't think that you can correlate success, quote-unquote, by American terms, with intelligence. Look at Trump, for God's sake. Look at Trump. He's a moron. Reagan was a moron. These are very successful individuals, you know? Oh, man. You guys are supposed to say amen or something when I say that. You guys are sitting there like, Diego's looking for the door, man.
No, well, I'm agreeing with you.
Look, man, I'm going under the table.
Well, no, I've said it before, right? I've worked for people that graduated MIT and got this overhead at Trader Joe's, stocking shelves with me.
There's a lot of stories like that.
But then I go, you see, it's who you know, what you know.
You got 2 to 4% of the population have PhDs, right? And it costs a lot of money to get a PhD, so I'm not very impressed. But let's just say that it's a big deal. So I read stories. I mean, you guys probably read these PhDs that are janitors, PhDs that are construction workers, PhDs that are that. There's no correlation between intelligence and getting that those big jobs. I mean, and for so many reasons, you know, networking
purposes. I'll give you another example.
Yeah.
Teachers who devote their summer months to going back to school and getting higher degrees leading to PhDs in their areas, and then get pink slipped anyway.
Where I grew up, the teachers, you want to do the quote, right?
Let's just wait.
Right, let's get to the environment thing, if you don't mind. Is that okay?
No, that's okay.
Because I got to do the Paul Ryan thing still. Anyway, so, sorry about that. So the, my teachers, where I grew up, this is the post-war upswing, right? So this is the 60s and 70s, supposedly, when they're making a lot of money. Think about this. Think about what they're doing now. My teachers, when I grew up, guess where I saw them? Cashiering in the local liquor store over the summer, working in the stores, you know, working retail, doing construction, actually, like painting houses, non-union, like painting houses and stuff, because the teacher salaries sucked. They were too low.
There were 2 months, no money, nothing coming in.
Well, I don't know how the teacher salaries work. They're supposed to make enough money to cover the summer. Isn't that how it's supposed to work? Yeah. Whether they get paid in the summer too, I don't know, but I should know that.
If you're in a union, it depends on if some teachers aren't.
Do you get a check in August if you're a teacher, or two checks in August or something? I don't know how it works. Do you know, Tom?
No.
Yeah. But anyway, the point is, obviously, a lot of teachers don't make enough, and they got to work part-time, or they work over the summers. It's hard to work a part-time job because of the hours when you're during the school year, but I bet some teachers do that as well. And it's just, and you know, the whole education system is just crap.
Well, I had a teacher ask me, are you guys hiring in Whole Foods? Because he has some type.
Yeah. I feel like saying that every day I walk around. I don't make enough money where I work. I feel, you know, when I pass the security guard, I feel like saying, is there any jobs in security? But my thing is, because of my kids, I'd have to just be on weekends. Then I wouldn't see them. It's like, I was doing that for a while, and I can't do it anymore. But anyway, Paul Ryan, scumbag. And if that's illegal to say, Paul Ryan, scumbag, I'll take the risk. He is a scumbag, because this is what he said. In fact, this is just so bad, I should be saying worse than scumbag. According to Time Magazine, quote, Paul Ryan said to this group of conservative idiots, quote, free lunches provided to children by government programs give kids a full stomach and an empty soul. Well, where do we start? Paul Ryan, Mr. Paul, there's no soul.
Soul, man. Sorry, guys.
My brain just froze like I just ate ice cream too quick.
But if souls existed, I would rather have an empty soul than an empty brain cavity. Paul Ryan, obviously. You know, my son showed me this cool book yesterday. There's just a series of books called Who Would Win or something like that. And it's animals fighting each other, like big animals fighting each other. It sounds kind of sick, but I like it. Anyway, orcas and great white sharks. Okay, first we'll get to the chase. Who guys do you think wins? The orca?
What's an orca?
An orca is a killer whale.
Okay.
Who wins in a fight between the killer whale and the great white out in the ocean?
I'm going to take a risk. Orca.
Orcas. Do you know why?
Because they're huge.
They're big.
To a shark.
Right? But also, well, some of the great white sharks are
pretty big. I was
going to
say shark because I say they come in packs.
No, they don't. That's the thing. Sharks don't, great whites at least, don't travel in packs.
Orcas do.
Gives them an advantage. Plus, they have big teeth. They're big. Yeah. They travel in packs. But they have a brain. Looks like a human brain. An orca brain looks just like a human brain. And, you know, so you figure there might be some correlation there. And they are considered very intelligent and trainable and so on. Great white. You know what the great white brain looks like? It's like a stem of a flower with two things cutting into it, like a Y shape, with none of that, like, brain matter or the connections or anything. It's just a killing machine, basically. Thank you, so-called God, right? So anyway, here's Paul.
Does it have a soul?
It's like capitalists.
Well, my point was...
Killer sharks,
yeah,
capitalists.
Exactly. My point was that Paul Ryan is the equivalent of a great white shark in capitalist society. He's got no brain, but he has a brain stem that's on greed, that's on power, that's hurt working people, and that's what Trump is like. There's the great white sharks are in charge
now. He's a ghost in the shell.
The capitalist great white sharks. So, let's see. Wait, we had another one, didn't we? What was the other Trumpism for the week? Oh, yeah, yeah. All right. So people, ICE is going around, emboldened by Trump. Who knows what the secret memos say. Go arrest everybody, right? Yeah.
American Gestapo.
I carry my passport everywhere.
So, yeah, you should. So you when they get attacked on this, they retreat to certain things they're supposed to make liberals feel better. I don't feel better about it because I don't believe in, you know, as a revolutionary socialist, no one should be getting deported. Borders are capitalist borders, you know, the whole thing. But leaving that aside for a second, here's one of the things they gave to the liberals. When you throw meat at the conservatives, what's it throwing at the liberals? Tofu? Here's the tofu they threw at the conservatives. Ready? Here we go.
Sprouts.
The dream. Yeah, here's some sprouts. Shut up. Here's some sprouts. Dreamer. The Dreamers, someone with a legal right to live, work, and study in the United States under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals DACA program. These people, we were told by Trump propagandists, and maybe Trump actually got his brain together enough to actually say this. Oh, we're not gonna deport them. You know how Trump talks, right? Like, no, they're okay. You know, he thinks he's in New York or something. He thinks he's talking to the what do you call those guys? The security guard, or there's another word for him in the apartment buildings.
Oh, the supers.
Yeah, he thinks he's having like a 3-second discussion with the super in his building. But he does this in the corporate media, of course. And so apparently this guy Juan Manuel Montes in California, he's walking in his hometown. In California, and ICE border officials approach him. Now, this is a real thing because I remember my sister lived in California for a short time, and I went out and visited her years ago, and I've heard it's the same way now. And you can have border checkpoints way into California, 50 miles into California, 100 miles border checkpoints. It's complete racial profiling.
San Diego happens all the time.
Yeah, I'm driving in this beat-up station wagon. They don't stop me. I look over who they're stopping. People with darker skin. You know, I mean, it's just complete. You're talking about racial profiling. It's always been around in the U.S. It's horrible. So anyway, obviously it's horrible. So here we go. They got this guy. He's legally authorized to live and work in America through the DACA program. And he's deported to Mexico just hours later after they rounded him up. This is a direct, and I'm quoting from
No time to defend yourself. You're not granted that.
Yeah, how'd they manage that in 3 hours or whatever? How'd they manage that? This is a direct consequence of Trump's mass deportation agenda and unaccountable legacy. Juan Manuel, who suffered a traumatic brain injury as a child, oh my God, has cognitive disability, must be reunited in his family as soon as possible. So they go after the weak, too. I mean, this is unbelievable.
Yeah, they get like a Gestapo attitude.
Then they say at the end, which is good, Move On members, because it's a liberal group I don't have much respect for, to be honest with you, but I'm glad they're reporting on this. Move On members are joining May Day actions across the country in solidarity with immigrant communities. Well, it's in solidarity with all workers, too. Save the date and look for more information soon on how to join May 1st strikes, boycotts, and rallies. And we're going to get into that in a minute. So anyways, that was some of the scummy Trump stuff. Now, you could be saying, how can I talk about bombing Syria and stuff like that, or saber rallying North Korea? We could talk about that. We hate that. That's horrible. But you notice with the North Korean thing, it was all a joke. You know, did you guys read the fine print? The Armada really was going the opposite way. Did you read about that?
No.
Trump said, we're coming at you with ships, but the ships were going the other way. And with Syria, they bombed some airfield that was up and running very soon. And I'm not saying that to minimize Trump's danger administration's danger.
He tells the kid, the Korean leader, behave like he's some child. Like,
yeah, behave.
Behave.
Well, you know what I saw on Facebook a lot, and I'm a little ignorant about this. Maybe you guys know the history better. I mean, part of it I know about, obviously, but I don't know the details. I saw things popping up after the saber rally against North Korea about how the United States had destroyed North Korea during the Korean War with like massive bombing, like Pyongyang was just destroyed. You were talking about that off air,
right?
Right.
That's right.
What was the extent of that? I mean, was it just like?
I think the extent of it really is that it's been. How many years since the Korean War? 55 years.
They wanted to drop atomic
like
bombs too, you said, right?
Yeah. 55 years since your whole country has been bombed to smithereens. You haven't forgotten that. That happened to your parents and your grandparents were killed off in that.
Maybe even them. People still live.
You know, I think you'd be parading missiles if you had them too. I'm not trying to defend.
Yeah, we don't like By the way, I don't mean to interrupt, but there's a funny thing about the Korean regime. some of the corporate media still refers to it as communist, and then even in the same report, they changed. They don't say that. Now, what I understand is that starting about when this guy took power, or before even the current dictator in Korea, North Korea, he ditched pseudo Stalinist, you know, Marxism or whatever they want to call it. They ditched Stalinism and put in a new philosophy. It begins with a J. I forget the name of it. And it's just like, you know, hyper-nationalism and stuff. I don't know how much of that is true. I don't know if they still talk, yammer around, you know, with Stalinist phraseology or not. But it's got nothing to do with socialism and Marxism.
J, by the way, South Korea was
their
under
own kind of jingle.
It's J-U-G-E,
South Korea was under a military dictatorship for decades.
Yeah, it's still
that
it's
never like, gets even
it's still like very South repressive. Vietnam.
Yeah, it's still very repressive.
In South Korea. But Trump was schooled by the premier of China, who said, "I've never seen anyone more ignorant of the history of this region," because he said that Korea was, you know, part of China, and the Koreans went, what?
Yeah. Well, a lot of the, there is a lot of ignorance about that.
Did you not know that Japan had it under control for some time after World War II, and that's why they have this hatred, blood boil hatred?
See, you guys know a lot more, I think, than most people about it. I'm hesitant to even weigh in here with my sketchy knowledge on the region in terms of, well, sketchy knowledge about North Korea, but the point is that, like with everything else, we're not taught that stuff. We don't get to travel much, you know? Yep. I mean, if you went to South Korea and spent some time there, you'd be like, this isn't
when,
so nice.
When
either,
you're not taught anything and you've got the liars at the top who have made a science of lying, it's what's the difference between that and Nazi Germany?
Yep. It's really, it's.
Well, I've seen a documentary where one of the president goes like, we're gonna send people to a place that most Americans can't even pinpoint on a map.
That happens a lot. Look at the Middle East.
Korea, where's that?
Yeah, that happens a lot. But and one thing we've talked about on the show before is that if you look at a lot of people don't know, the Middle East, the borders in the Middle East, of countries in the Middle East, were largely created to, after World War II, to help British and American and French imperialism divide up the oil spoils there, divide up all the oil fields and stuff, and cutting across tribal lines, cutting across nationalistic lines, cutting across cultural and ethnic lines. And so they just created this recipe for, you know, divide and conquer, which they wanted, but also for turmoil. Divide and conquer doesn't always go the way you set it up, because you've created such division and so on. Not that things were great before then, but people have the right to their own self-determination.
Well,
not
you
to
also have Winston Churchill. Military complex.
Winston Churchill sent some guy into another room with a protractor to draw a circle around that big oil field in Kuwait. We'll call that Kuwait, you know?
In Iraq.
Yeah, in Iraq it had huge oil. Anyway, we're going to talk about May 1st now, if that's all right. Is that all right? Go on to that. And try not to forget about the March on Science. Diego has a quote by Einstein for that. Ginger Jensen's campaign and so on. But right now, let's shift gears. May 1st is International Workers' Day. And this was... starting in 1886, came out of the Haymarket Martyrs in Chicago. So it's an American holiday originally, believe it or not, where protesters for the eight-hour day, big protests, were harassed by the police, which was nothing strange at the time, and they were attacked. There was a police provocateur, or else maybe a protester threw a bomb, and the police used that as an excuse to go in and hurt people, kill people and arrest people, there was a mass witch hunt mentality against the people that were arrested. Then they became known as the Haymarket Martyrs, because eventually, through all the zealous nationalism and pro-capitalism and so on, thrown out there by the state of Illinois and by the country as a whole, the leaders, the elites in the country as a whole, they managed to hang. How many of the Haymarket Martyrs? Eight of them, or something like that?
Yeah, I think it was eight.
And they were known as anarchists at the time. Anarchism and socialism were still in formation. There was a little kind of...
They were actual organizers. They were dedicated organizers and militants who went around and gave speeches to organize unions.
Yep. They were. What I'm trying to get at is the kind of, like, a lot of anarchists want to sort of own May 1st, and I can understand that, but I disagree with it because the lines that were drawn later through through struggle and theory were not as well drawn yet between anarchism and socialism, and people would sort of
I think that was the year Marx died or whatever, also, right?
I don't remember.
But around that time, Marxism was just, you know, kind of new, and this whole idea.
Yeah, and there was a big there was differentiation happening between anarchism and socialism, definitely. But it was not it wasn't as clear as it became later, and there's still some mushing over there amongst for some people. But anyway, for example, Albert Spies, the best known Haymarket martyr. His wife was Lucy Parsons. Famous African-American, well, should be famous, African-American, you know, I guess anarchist then, but later became a communist and part of the Communist Party. Like a lot of people move from that kind of IWW or whatever. That's IWW was after Haymarket, but, you know, International Workers of the World is what I'm referring to. They moved from sort of an anarcho-syndicalist position to, once the Russian Revolution happened, they moved to supporting communism, socialism, you know, revolutionary socialism and so on. So anyway, without getting too far into the history, the Haymarket martyrs who were fighting for the eight-hour day, along with many others, that became a big cause in the country, people trying to save them from being hanged and so on. And it did have some effect. I think a few of them were pardoned or given prison sentences, later pardoned. This was the beginnings of May Day, May 1st, and it started in the United States. And very quickly, it became an international holiday, taken up by the Second International and other groups, socialist groups around the world, to the point where now May 1st is like a holiday in most countries for workers. But it doesn't stop there. It's not like our kind of lame Labor Day. May 1st is also a day to protest and strike for what you need that year, for what the main fights are. Right. It doesn't always happen, but it happens a lot all over the world, underdeveloped countries, developed countries, whatever. And it's a very important holiday that we don't celebrate and most Americans don't know about. But there are always, as long as I've been politically active, there have been people trying to keep the tradition alive. So in the 80s...
Well, Labor Day was created in order to water down the impact of May Day.
I've heard two different things about that. It was used to water down the impact of May Day, but originally it was a legitimate labor holiday, like legitimately...
Yeah.
Like this guy, Philip Foner, that I've read a lot about, he was a Stalinist, but whatever. He wrote a lot of labor history, very detailed labor history. So he wrote a book about May 1st, May Day. And his claim is, and it seems to make sense given his sources and so on, that Labor Day did have some legitimacy within the labor movement. I forget why that particular day was important, though. That's the part I don't remember, which is bad. But it really came out of the labor movement, and not as a reaction, actually, initially to May 1st. In other words, they were going to have more than one labor holiday. They didn't see anything wrong with that. In fact, July 4th used to be considered a labor holiday. A lot of people used to, in the workers' movement, said that was when we did the fighting. We revolted. That's our holiday. Makes a certain amount of sense.
We killed the Native Americans.
Well, were they doing that during the Revolution? Yeah, kind of. They were, because there were Native Americans joined British or... Yeah, okay. Yeah. You're right. Yeah, and also it was a fight not for socialism or anything. It was a fight for another, you know, fight to independence from England. But it was a... In a way, a progressive thing in certain ways, yeah, not. But people perceived it as a workers' holiday for a while. That fell into more of a nationalistic, jingoistic camp. Yeah. And Labor Day was, like you said, yeah. And like you said, Tom, I think Labor Day was used consciously. I don't know when exactly it started, probably the early 1900s, as Barry May Day. Promote Labor Day. That definitely happened, but I don't think it started out that way initially. I could be wrong.
No.
But then May Day did continue into the United States in a big way in certain places, like in New York City into the 30s, because of the size of the Communist Party there. You had big May 1st parades and some other major cities. But now, yeah, pretty much
I've seen pictures of Boston May Day around the turn of the 20th century.
How was it?
As far down Tremont
Street.
Wow,
that's great.
Side to side, sidewalks,
brilliant.
Everything.
I didn't know that.
Thousands and thousands of
people. Try stopping that, coppers.
Well, one reason for this, which is a very, very important reason, is that immigrant workers have come into the United States, obviously, in floods from time to time, often bringing socialist traditions from their own country into the United States. And that has kept May 1st alive in a lot of ways. So in the 80s, for example, there was in Boston small efforts to keep May 1st alive that usually was like have a little march somewhere like in an immigrant neighborhood and then go have dinner. I was like part of those, a few of those, right? Then in the 90s, there were attempts to broaden it out a little more, but it was still based mostly on immigrant communities. And then the big culmination was 2006, the famous Day Without an Immigrant, big protest that was actually turned into strikes for a lot of immigrant workers. They left their jobs for one day, and it was huge in a lot of cities. And that put May 1st back on the map to a certain extent. And I think it stayed there like in Worcester, there's a community labor group that has immigrant rights groups in it, but they say they've been doing May Day stuff for 12 years. I've only seen it for the last few years. And that would bring us back to before 2006 or around 2006? Around 2006. So, you know, I think that had an effect of probably keeping May Day alive, International Workers' Day alive in a lot of areas. And it still happens. Now, this May 1st might even be, it's not going to probably be as big as a Day Without Immigrants, but it might be big because some unions have agreed to actually go on strike. And some of them passed, I know of one union that passed one large union grouping passed a thing to go on strike May 1st, but they didn't. It had to go to another vote, and it didn't pass that vote. But some are
just talking about a 24-hour strike.
Yes. So here we go. I'm quoting from Socialist Alternatives newspaper. Socialist Alternative. There's an article in the current issue. May 1st, all out against Trump, by Shama Sawant, Seattle City Council member of Socialist Alternative. The most important May development so far in California, where 340,000. Service workers are preparing for strike action led by a coalition including SEIU, United Service Workers West, and Immigrant Workers Centers. Quote, the president is attacking our community, said Tomas Mejia, a member of USWW's executive board. Immigrants have helped form this country. We've contributed to its beauty, but the president is attacking us as criminal. A caravan against fear is also being organized by the coalition to travel throughout the state of California during the month of April to build for May 1st action. The president of United Teachers Los Angeles, Alex Caputo Pearl, has called on Superintendent Michelle King to shut down schools district-wide May 1st. Well, that's in Los Angeles. That's huge. In the Bay Area, the San Francisco Labor Council issued a statement on March 7th endorsing worker solidarity actions on May 1st and asking that there be no retaliation against any worker, union or non-union, who chooses to exercise their civil rights by taking the day off. Washington State, momentum around May 1st has also been growing in Washington State. Now, this is no accident. When you have the you don't have to believe me, listeners, but the fallout, or not fallout, that's a negative, the ripple effect, that's nicer, right? The ripple effect of Shama, an open socialist, getting elected and reelected, and the work that Socialist Alternative has done in Seattle has created, I think, a lot of ripple effects out there. One I can tell you right away that is pretty obvious is that there are more independents running for office out there now. There's a guy who used to be a Democrat named John Grant running now as an independent. And there is, and I think he supports Shama. And then there's a person running for mayor, Michelle King, who started her own party, forget the name of it, who's running as an independent against the mayor of Seattle. This is because people have seen we won this, you know, as Socialist Alternative, and it can be done. And that's a good thing. It'd be better if they were running with us or whatever, but, you know, whatever. We're not running candidates for those positions. In Martin Luther King County, which includes Seattle, the County Labor Council voted to urge its affiliate unions to consider all forms of action on May 1st, 2017, whether striking, walking out, taking sick days, extended lunch hours, exercising rights of conscience, organizing demonstrations or teach-ins, or any other acts of collective expression. This kind of flexibility has been stressed by organizers around the country who want to minimize retaliation against workers while building for the broadest, most powerful possible May 1st actions. And that's, we support that as well. Like, we're using the word strike in a way we normally wouldn't use it, where we don't have any illusions that AFL-CIO is going to call a general strike or something. But where an individual union wants to, or where even workers themselves want to call it a strike, we're supporting that. A number of other unions in Seattle have also passed May Day resolutions, including WFSE Local 304, representing workers at Seattle Community Colleges, and IBW Local 46, representing electrical workers. At the University of Washington, the largest university in the Northwest, 6,000 graduate student workers represented by UAW Local 4121 will soon be voting to go on strike. I think I heard they did vote for that. As a member of City Council, this is Shama Swan speaking. I used my platform here in Seattle to call on the city's Mayor Murray to allow all city workers to take May 1st off without retaliation. Washington state law already allows all public employees to take 2 days off each year for reasons of conscience or religion. But the biggest development in Seattle are the Seattle Education Association, SEA, where 5,000 teachers will soon be voting on whether to shut down the city's public schools for the day in response to longtime unconstitutional underfunding of schools in Washington state. Now, I'm not sure that passed or not. I'd really like to know that. Should have tried to find out for the show. Didn't think of it. Sorry. In Illinois, the Chicago Teachers Union also weighing whether to hold a one-day strike on May Day. I doubt they're going to follow through on that. They've been sucking up to Rahm Emanuel lately, but hopefully I'm wrong. Other unions around the country, such as the Minnesota Nurse Association, have also passed resolutions in favor of action on May Day. So it's hard to say who's going to follow through and who isn't at this point, but that's exciting. That's the best. That's probably, in some ways, in terms of breadth of unions, that's bigger than Day Without an Immigrant in 2006, May 1st, 2006. Although SEIU did get behind a lot of the action that day. But this is more than just SEIU, obviously. Here locally in Boston, there's going to be a rally put out the Boston May Day Coalition, which originally started by Socialist Alternative years ago. That's going to be at 5 p.m. at the Bandstand in Boston Common. Then I think earlier in the day, there's a rally that's encompassing Chelsea and East Boston and maybe Everett or somewhere. And anyone know where that one is? I don't have the information on where it's going to be.
I think it's at the City Hall.
Which one? Chelsea City Hall. Do you know what time? Maybe 3 p.m.
I've heard different times. That's the problem. Yeah. Anyway. I've heard 3 o'clock and then I've heard 5 o'clock.
It usually is around 3 o'clock. That march starts in Maverick, goes right to the...
Yeah.
I remember. You've done it before, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Maverick, East Boston, that bridge right into Chelsea.
Yep.
Sometimes, one time it actually went all the way to Ferry Street, Everett, right off of Broadway.
That's
a big march.
Yeah, that was a big march.
We're approaching the noon hour here, so I got to give our legal ID. We are WMFO Medford or WMFO in Medford. We call ourselves Tufts Educational Radio, Tufts Freeform Commercial-Free Community-Based Radio, and we're a little slice of that community-based socialist alternative radio, talk and music for me. Working class, democratic socialist perspective, and we're here every other Sunday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Your hosts today are Diego, Tom, and myself, Jeff. And with your permission, comrades, we will take a short musical interlude. Is that okay?
That's all right.
Yeah, all right.
So I see it's the Clash, right?
I have to admit, I'm putting things up that we
Washington
have played.
Bullets.
We have played before
you. Before you put that on, can I just?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead. Sorry.
Can I just ask?
Absolutely.
Do either of you remember who were the main speakers in Chelsea in 2006? The big march. Were they?
The big march in 2006 was downtown. It was not in Chelsea. I don't remember who the speakers were. Do you guys?
Well, I just hope that there's some union leaders that are out there speaking and not just city.
There were union leaders back in 2006. Yeah, yeah. Definitely. Yeah,
the one I went to, I remember at Ferry Street, you had the Teamster, what's his name, the son of Hoffa.
Oh god, no. Well, you also had speakers from SEIU like Seance, Rosa Seance, who became known out in California with the Justice for Janitors movement.
That's
and then
right.
Moved out to Boston.
That's
But I don't, there's definitely will be union speakers. But yeah, I understand what you're saying. Then they trot up the Democrats up on the stage, and the whole thing falls into the pit of the slow of wrecking social movements. I don't see a lot of that this May 1st, but I don't know. We'll see. I mean, Trump, of course, you know, we're not naive. Trump makes the Democrats look good, but we also have a memory. We know what the Democrats have done. We know what they're doing right now at the city level, state level, in a lot of places. So no illusions.
Voting against
illusions
15
in corporate.
An hour.
We still have wounds
the Janus,
with salt being poured.
Yeah. No illusions in the corporate Democrats or the corporate Republicans or the corporate Libertarians where they might crawl out of their holes. So we're going to do a quick musical interlude here and come back. You're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio on WMFO 91.5 FM.